This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
So glad to have you back with us as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, and open innovation. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online and webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Exciting show today. We're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from someone a lot of us never heard of, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program, and of course at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Right now, though, to tell us about the lineup for today's show, here is Jack Bishop.
And thank you very much. Jack Bishop here for the Science News Network. Joining us today is Dr. Mark Asani. He is, amongst other things, the Robert M. Kennedy Endowed Professor at Texas A&M. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us from College Station.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you're going to be the keynote speaker coming up at the IEEE conference in Corpus Christi in April, and you're going to be talking about an area that has been in the news here of late that many of us have taken note of, and that is sustainable energy and vehicle engineering. Now, I'm an old car guy from the West Coast, so this whole thing about vehicles and alternative fuels and alternative methodology is really kind of exciting to a kid who grew up listening to the sound of a big block Chevy. You're going to be talking about this at the conference, April 3rd through 4th, by the way, and that's at the IEEE Green Technologies Conference, as we said, in Corpus Christi at the Omni Hotel. It's sponsored by the IEEE 5th Regional District. Is that right?
That is correct.
And, Doctor, what do you hope to tell everybody?
Well, I have been spending the past quarter century developing some key technologies and systems for sustainable vehicles, specifically hybrid electric vehicle technologies. But over the past 40 years, I've been working on energy systems in various ways. And all these things together have converged into my current interest over the past 10 years on sustainability of energy and sustainability of vehicles. So I have developed some insights, both technical and kind of at a high level, system level and social level, which I hope to share with these folks in this conference, some of which may be a little surprising to them because everybody is a promoter of this little thing or that little thing or even this kind of utopian dream, but I try to look at it in a much more practical way that not only helps our fellow man and our country, but is real without having an angle in it or a dog in the race, as they say.
I was reading an article today talking about this kind of technology for us laymen as far as new vehicle product that's out there. And one of the things that struck me was one of the things I read today said, as much as we talk about the electric vehicle, the hydrogen fuel vehicle may really be the way we'll end up going. Your thoughts on that?
I'm afraid I'm not going to be very encouraging. Now, hydrogen, as clean and wonderful as it sounds, has many fundamental problems, which really, my personal belief is that technology cannot overcome because they're very fundamental to the laws of nature and physics and chemistry. And one of them is that hydrogen is not a natural fuel. It has to be produced. In order to produce it, something else has to burn, whether it's nuclear fuel or natural gas or coal or whatever. And this process of burning some other natural fuel to produce electricity, to produce hydrogen, to then ship it around and do this and that, overall tends to be not very efficient as compared to using some of the natural fuels directly for the end purpose, number one. And number two, hydrogen is not a very easy fuel to pipe, or meaning transmit, and to tank, meaning carry on board the vehicle. There are several issues fundamental about it. So I personally do not think that that is going to happen.
So all the information that's being spread out there about hydrogen being the way we're going to ultimately end up probably is, as you're saying, it's you can't change physics, you can't change the fundamentals of physics. Now, there have been two vehicles here in the last few months that have gotten an awful lot of press, and I just want to mention them in passing. One, of course, is the Tesla, which has just gotten rave reviews from all of the scientific people, all of the car community magazines, and good response as far as the marketplace. And the other has been this new Cadillac Coupe. Are these really, from what you've heard, as neat a vehicle as all of the car magazines claim they are?
No, not at all. Again, here we are dealing with media sensationalization. The primary purpose would be to excite, to enthuse, to get attention, regardless of technical, scientific, or for that matter, even commercial foundations of the claim, because they're not really responsible 5 years from now to for what they've said before, however strongly and enthusiastic they may have said it. So as long as that day sounds exciting, the purpose of the media is done. But there are unfortunately laws of physics that don't change over days, months, years, and eons, and a serious technologist has to pay attention to that. Let me, having given this little sermon, let me go back to the Tesla car, which is in fact a recently successful product formation of or representation of the electric vehicle. The Tesla automobile, I've driven it. It's a wonderful, exciting car. It does several things very well. And I think it's going to have a niche in the market as an exciting car with a success in the defined niche. Now, as long as you don't get carried away with the claims that the manufacturer or the easily excitable media say about it. Now, a niche market that is very successful, very exciting, could be a Tesla car, it could be Maserati, it could be Ferrari. All these cars have been around for 100 years. They're very exciting. I don't anticipate buying one nor being able to afford one, and I would take a wild guess that neither would you, and perhaps many among the audience that might be hearing this interview. Having said that, it is an exciting car. It is a niche car, but here's the problem. Again, it goes back to the fundamental laws of physics. An electric vehicle has to store its energy in an electrochemical battery and then run with it. And you cannot have the density or the small size for the tank, which in this case is a battery, to be small enough to be anywhere comparable to, say, a tank of gasoline or diesel fuel. It's fundamentally impossible. And the reason for that is very simple. When you run around with a tank of gasoline or diesel in your fuel, actually you're only carrying half of your fuel. The other half is the oxygen, which you happen to be floating in, and it's free and it's available everywhere. And so you only carry half of what you need to burn that fuel to produce energy. Whereas in a battery, you carry both the fuel and the oxidant in the box, and then all the materials in between to actually oxidize the fuel and then produce electricity from it. And that makes it significantly bigger, heavier, and more expensive than a tank of gas. And so a tank of gas and an internal combustion engine will always be any ideal battery that man will ever be able to build from chemistry and an electric motor. So I look at Tesla as a successful market product that, if it survived the initial excitement, it'll taper off and become something like Ferrari. And by the way, the prices are also more or less in the same league as these niche.
$100,000 plus.
Plus, exactly. I want to tell you one other thing. The issue of range anxiety, you know, sometimes I drive go skiing in Colorado from Texas, and I don't plan to have any anxieties about how I'm going to do this one-way 850-mile trip. With the gasoline, I don't have to do that. But and I actually go three-quarters of that with one tank of gas. That's not possible with an electric vehicle. And now, imagine if this car was going to be driven in Alaska or in Minnesota or Nebraska in the winter. The chemical battery becomes much more sluggish, and it forgets a significant percentage of its charge when it experiences a 20 below or 30 below or 40 below zero nighttime. And so you would have to keep it warm. So that means you have to have a heater, this, that, the other. So it's really, you know, there's a fundamental reason why everything that moves on this planet, including earthworms and dogs and cats and humans, are internal combustion engines. Because the way this planet is formed, if you have the oxygen readily available, all you have to carry is the hydrocarbon. Or in our case, it's sugar in our blood. In the case of the vehicle, it's the hydrocarbon fuel in the gas tank. Now, I'm not a promoter of oil on this path. I don't have any investment or anything in that area. But we have to be realistic about these things. And whatever really unique advantage that electric vehicle has, namely that it can actually recharge its battery from decelerating or slowing down the vehicle, so-called regenerative braking, in other words, taking the moving energy of the vehicle and putting it back in the battery, can also be had with a hybrid electric vehicle, which also takes advantage of hydrocarbon fuels and internal combustion engine. So I believe that after 40 years of study and 25 years in advanced vehicles, that in the long run, either we get off personal transportation and we go into a different order of society, and that's not likely to happen in my lifetime or your lifetime, but we will move to much better engineered hybrid electric vehicles that has the combined advantage of electric vehicles and conventional cars.
So the internal combustion engine is, for the foreseeable future, the way we're going to go.
That's my best technical and scientific judgment. I don't say that with any kind of enthusiasm for the winners or losers. This is just what I have been working on, and it's my best judgment. Now, the challenge is to make these cars better and cost compatible with conventional cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be done, actually. But we've been missing that mark, again, because of some misconceptions and some initial enthusiasm about hybrid electric vehicles. If you look at the Prius and some of the early hybrid electric vehicles, they followed a philosophically different line. And the line was, let's maximize the fuel economy. And in the process, the engine became so small and the batteries and so on became so big that if you run out of charge, which you invariably can happen to you, you end up with a fairly low-performance vehicle because you're back on the backs of a small engine. Now, if you take, for example, almost a conventional car with a full-size engine, and then add a minimum, engineering well-designed balance of battery and electric motor to that, you end up a car that is better than a conventional car because it accelerates better, it feels better, it saves fuel mainly due to regeneration or the braking power that you put back in the battery, but it's never worse than a conventional car because you always have that engine with you, but you just don't use its fuel as much. And such a car, our research has shown, for example, can be produced with a cost differential with a conventional car, which is going to be something like $3,000 or less than $5,000 in mass production. Anybody would buy a car which is fuel efficient, actually has a better sporty feeling, and many other advantages that electronics and electrically controlled propulsion can give you. You know, basically modernity for $3,000 difference. You know, that's practically the price of one of the major options that people get in their cars.
So the real question becomes how to make them more fuel efficient and also how to get them to the point where they're priced competitively with what we're used to paying, essentially. Let me tell everybody that you're listening to the Science News Network. I'm Jack Bishop. We're talking with Dr. Mark Asani. Doctor, you said, and at the start of the program, that one of your areas of expertise and interest is sustainable energy, and that to me is a big, big question. I had an uncle who served in World War II with a tanker unit, and he said whenever Patton got in front of his lines for supplies of gasoline and such, they were not above raiding the Germans for some of the synthetic fuel that they were using. And he said, we just retarded the spark on those old Cadillac V8s that we had in our tanks, and they would run pretty good on this synthetic fuel. Now, if that happened almost 70 years ago, how come we're not doing more development in the area of synthetic fuel to replace petrochemical fuels?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I'm afraid, again, I'm going to be anti-climatic with my answer. Number one, we are the technology of producing synthetic fuels is really not that difficult and is well at hand, and given enough enthusiasm, support, and need, it can advance very quickly. It's not a difficult technology compared to some of the great accomplishments that we have done in this country, including, you know, going to the moon and solving many difficult problems. But I'm afraid that that incentive is not there and will not be there for a long time for the following fundamental reason. So I'm going to give you the bad news first and then the good news.
Sounds like an idea.
Well, let's say that our motivation for going to synthetic fuel is to save the planet Earth from greenhouse gases and so on and so forth, and not some of the other kind of emotional arousing topics like energy independence, national security, and these other things, which are very complex, and any simple one-track solutions for them is really, you know, should be left to the promoters and partisans. Now, if in fact our interest is to save the planet, keep the planet green, greenhouse gases, and what so on and so forth, what happens if, for example, we get off of oil in this country? First of all, you must understand that we have well in excess of 300 years of oil available to us in North America from local sources, America and Canada. There is no shortage of hydrocarbon fuels in this country. You might say there is a shortage after 400 years or 300 years, but we're just politically, intellectually, and technologically are not in the habit of solving the problems of 300 years from now. Or at least it loses its urgency, and many other, you know, things could intervene in the meantime. But if we did, for some reason, because we all of a sudden decide that America should be the leader and that we should be true to our own principles and to Mother Earth and our children, grandchildren, and all these wonderful things, what do you think happens if we, in 10 years or 20 years, go to zero oil consumption because we can do synthetic fuel and recycle the carbon in the atmosphere through the plants and all that good stuff and make our cars efficient, do everything else that everybody imagines and hopes for? If where does that oil go if we don't use it? Will it stay in the ground? Will people say, well, if Americans aren't using it, we shouldn't eat? No. What's going to happen is the market will adjust its price so that oil becomes readily available to those who cannot use it in abundance to grow as they wish to now. That would be India, China, Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, all the other places in the world that are just not where they should be for basic modern human life. So, I mean, ultimately, if nobody uses oil, the price of oil is going to go to zero because it's a useless commodity. Imagine how many uses can be thought of for oil if its price went to zero. For one thing, you can imagine that Saudi Arabia and other producers will do exactly what Kodak camera company did and Hewlett Packard computer company does. They sell you the camera or the printer for very low cost, but now you're hooked and you buy the film and the toner for the printer for a high price, very often, and you deliver all the profit that was intended by the manufacturer. So Saudi Arabia could very well go around the world and offer to build oil power plants for free, or Indians, Africans, even the Chinese, as long as they buy the oil from them.
Right, right.
And who could resist that when you're an underdeveloped country? And electrification is the lifeblood of education, health, economy, productivity, human dignity.
Well, so, as we say here in Texas, it's a heck of a deal.
It's a heck of a deal. So now solve this problem for me. You can't go clean by yourself, even if you could, in spite of a lack of economic incentive, because we will have inexpensive, accessible oil for hundreds of years, and its equivalent natural gas, which is on top of that. And if we did go clean, everybody else will jump on it and use it even more aggressively. Because what happens is when it becomes accessible, they will develop, and when they develop, they will need more of it, just like we did as we developed. So that's the bad picture. Now, what's the good picture? Here's what America should do. America should do what America has always done to make the world better, more inspired, more enlightened. We should have, a market-motivated Marshall Plan. You know, to lift the world out of its poverty with something that ultimately will benefit us economically. So we Americans, with our advanced technology, advanced universities, enormous wealth, enormous dynamicness of the commercial sector, should be developing sustainable energy products for export. We should be developing things to produce electricity, to mobilize mobility for people of the world, the rest of the world, especially under the developed world, in such a way that they actually prefer to the hydrocarbon fuels that they have to buy at a high price, or burning their forests, or you know, whatever, you know. So it's kind of like the way we export McDonald's hamburgers and Kentucky Fried Chickens and these things, you know.
We give them something they want.
We give them something they want, and they prefer to their local stuff.
Doctor, you make it sound so simple now. You know, that even a guy who doesn't have a background in chemistry and physics can say, yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly. But it is simple once you get rid of the complicated dysfunctional enthusiasm and public euphoria and hysteria. You know, if it's not, look, people cannot do anything that is not simple. But to break it down to that level and clean the table of all the extras, that's the hard part. There are small companies I've been recently reading in the UK and in this country that are actually, for example, I'll give you an example. They're producing $75 solar electric generators that can be sold to African small town or villagers that they would prefer to kerosene lamps inside their huts. Because they have to pay 10 times more for the energy that they get from kerosene for lighting than we in this country pay for our electric energy for lighting. Imagine, poor people pay 10 times more for lighting than we do.
Doctor, I hate to do this. We have run out of time. Let me remind everybody that Dr. Asadi will be the featured keynote speaker coming up in April at the IEEE conference in Corpus Christi, and it's certainly going to be a chance for you to hear more of him talking about the very items and things that we have discussed in this little snippet. And Doctor, you've told me how come I'm not driving an electric car today.
Yeah, don't feel like you're missing out on anything.
Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Yaron Ezrahi. The most arbitrary powers in history, always hid under the claim of some impersonal logic. God, the laws of nature, the laws of the universe. And they always provoked a backlash when morally intolerable discrepancies became glaringly visible.